You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The last convoy of American troops drove out of Iraq on Sunday, bringing to an end nearly 9 years of war and occupation that claimed around 4,500 American lives and cost an estimated $1 trillion. The future of Iraq remains uncertain, though, and this week's sectarian feuding in the government is threatening to unravel the delicate coalition and suggests that the situation post-withdrawal may become increasingly dangerous. Joining us now from Baghdad, our Wall Street Journal correspondent Sam Dagger and New York Times correspondent Michael Schmidt. Welcome to our show. And we also want to alert our audience to the fact that there'll be a little delay as a result of the complicated telephone connections that we have. Hi, Sam. Let's begin with you.
Hi, Leonard. Good morning to you and to your listeners.
Combat troops have left, but who stayed behind?
Well, I mean, there's the embassy, and it's the biggest in the world. And we heard earlier that the U.S. is working toward a State Department presence here in the tune of 15,000 to 16,000, and this would include a lot of contractors, particularly security contractors. But in terms of actual military officers, we know that there are 157 who are a part of this Office of Foreign Military Sales, and then there are some private defense contractors that are training the Iraqis currently on equipment that was purchased from the U.S. We're talking about tanks and what have you.
The withdrawal comes after the U.S. failed to reach an agreement with the Iraqi government that would extend the military presence there. What were the sticking points in those negotiations?
Well, basically, it was the issue of immunity. The U.S. was adamant that whoever stayed behind should be able to enjoy immunity from prosecution in accordance to Iraqi laws. And the Iraqi government couldn't make up its mind. I mean, I was told by a couple of senior Iraqi officials that I've interviewed over the past couple of months that a lot of them, with one exception, and that is Muqtada al-Sadr, the firebrand Shia cleric here who's allied to Iran, pretty much all of them wanted the U.S. troops to stay, but couldn't actually come out and say it publicly. They feared, you know, this could cause a backlash. This could somehow allow someone like Mr. Sadr and other so-called nationalists to come out and exploit this. So at the end, they basically have no choice but to reject this a request for immunity from the U.S. And plus, you know, the Iraqis were saying this would have required us to go to Parliament, and this would have been quite a contentious and drawn-out process, you know, given how things have similar things in the past have been dealt with, particularly the security agreement that was signed ultimately between the U.S. and Iraq that led up to the full withdrawal of troops this year, you know, last week.
But we can understand why the Iraqis might not want to grant immunity to American troops. Hasn't that led to troubles in the past?
Of course. I mean, there have been some pretty high-profile incidents of, you know, soldiers shooting at people who perhaps, you know, did not stop at checkpoints. I mean, there are countless incidents in that regard. Some of them obviously were, a lot of them were investigated by the U.S., and in some instances, there's been prosecution. I mean, particularly if you recall that horrible incident a couple of years ago where a soldier was charged with, you know, raping and then killing a family and setting it on fire, you know, setting their bodies on fire. And that was a pretty horrendous incident that really, affected the Iraqis in a big way. And then you have the Mansour Square incident in Baghdad where private security contractors working for the embassy were responsible for the shooting of a number of Iraqis.
Now, Michael, this week Iraq is in the midst of a serious political crisis. Its vice president, Tariq al-Hashimi, has been accused of ordering his security guards to assassinate government officials. How has he responded?
He went on the offensive yesterday and held a press conference refuting the charges and claiming that the government, led by Prime Minister Nouri Kamal al-Maliki, who is a Shiite, was going after him, trying to settle political differences, and that his guards had coerced these confessions out of Mr. Hashimi's bodyguards, that Mr. Hashimi had ordered them to commit acts of terrorism.
Is that likely? Doesn't he have a reputation as being something of a moderate?
I mean, it's pretty hard to tell where truth starts here. It's hard to tell. A lot of these politicians have had, you know, small militias of bodyguards that have done more than just protect them. And this has been an ongoing issue for many years. It's often been believed that many of these politicians have engaged in this stuff, but few cases have come and become so public like this one.
Do Sunnis see this as persecution, a way to rid the government of a prominent Sunni and send a message to Sunnis nationwide?
Yes, it sends a message to them that they are very scared that they're going to be marginalized and pushed away, and that the Shiites are going to continue to amass power. And they see this as, you know, coming just days after the United States leaves. To them, this is just a sign of what's going to come in the years ahead. And they've reacted with a lot of angst.
Hasn't Hashimi left Baghdad for Kurdistan? Why there?
Because it's harder for the Prime Minister's security forces to get him up in Kurdistan. Kurdistan is a semi-autonomous region, and there are different security forces up there. So Prime Minister Maliki today demanded that the Kurds hand Mr. Hashimi back to the authorities in Baghdad, and the Kurds responded by saying no. So all of a sudden now you have the Sunnis upset at the Shiites because Mr. Maliki is going after Mr. Hashimi, and now the Kurds are saying to Mr. Maliki, saying, no, you know, we're not going to play along. We're not going to hand over Mr. Hashimi. So all of a sudden, you know, just 3 days after the United States left, all three groups are staring each other down.
Sam, what's the response from the United States been to this whole thing?
Well, I mean, so far there's been no comment from the U.S. Embassy here in Baghdad, but the ambassador has met with a couple of Sunni officials, most notably the Speaker of Parliament, Nujafi, who is a member of the same bloc to which Hashimi belongs. And we've heard some comment from the State Department spokesman in Washington a couple of days ago saying that they were monitoring the situation. And I believe there were also calls by Vice President Biden to a number of the political players here, most notably Prime Minister Maliki.
So is the United States planning to continue to have a role in mediating political crises like this?
Well, it seems so, but I think we have to keep in mind one very important thing here, that this power struggle has been going on for years. I mean, it's nothing new, and it's pretty acrimonious and pretty bloody at times. And I do agree with what Michael noted in terms of, you know, how these all these political factions have their own militias, so to speak, and now, you know, that the U.S. has left, at least militarily, this seems to be a signal to all of them to press ahead with their respective agendas. And what's making matters worse is, you know, what's going on in the region. Because you have, you know, the so-called Arab Spring, which has turned pretty messy and bloody now with what's going on next door in Syria, which Maliki today in his press conference likened to a house on fire. And then add to that, you know, all the, you know, the different the machinations by the regional players, you know, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Iran, all of them are trying to sort of, you know, move things in their favor. be it in the Arabs, in the events that are taking place in the Arab world, in places like Bahrain, Syria, Yemen, and elsewhere, or here in Iraq. And we're starting to see more of it here in Iraq. And obviously, what Maliki does tends to be the most headline grabbing, because he is at the helm of power and controls, pretty much the security forces, all the other leaders of power. But other people are also involved in this struggle, most notably the president of the Kurdistan region, who has come out publicly a couple months ago saying, I expect a civil war in Iraq, Sunnis and Shiites killing each other, and we Kurds are not going to be part of it, but it seems like, he's being sucked into it.
My guests are Sam Dagher, who is a Wall Street Journal correspondent based in Baghdad, and Michael Schmidt, who is there for the New York Times. Michael, can you describe how the coalition government has been constructed? Aren't there sectarian quotas based on mathematical formulae?
What happened, there was an election over a year ago, actually a year and 9 months ago, and that election didn't have a clear-cut winner, and they went without a government for 9 months. And over that period of time, the United States got involved and created this idea of a power-sharing government, which ultimately led to Prime Minister Maliki, who didn't get the most votes in the election, becoming the prime minister. And it was an inclusive government. The thought was to get all the parties inside the government in the hopes that would sort of, get everyone together. What's happened is that the government, since it was formed exactly a year ago, has done very little. Very few people can, the blocs can't agree on anything. They've accomplished little. The problems, of the economy and poverty and stuff like, clean water and sewage have gone on unresolved over that period of time. So it's really been a political stalemate here, as the United States has left and the security situation has kind of remained the same, with, attacks pretty much across the country on a daily basis, although it's been quiet in recent weeks.
But we now have these accusations of attempted assassinations. Have there been political assassinations?
There was a large spike in assassinations earlier this year with silencer guns. And different government officials were being killed almost on a daily basis, and it was very concerning. And the government put into effect laws that said if you had a silencer weapon and you were caught with it, you'd go to jail for the rest of your life. And there was, the United States military got involved and was trying to advise the Iraqis on how to combat this problem. And there was a thought that it was sort of, political, politicians getting involved in this and using that type of violence to outmaneuver their rivals. And sort of when the government came out and said this about Mr. Hashemi, it sort of confirmed in the minds of many that, some politicians had been behind it.
My guests are Michael Schmidt, New York Times correspondent, Wall Street Journal correspondent Sam Dagher. We're talking about post-occupation Iraq. Stay with us for more. We'll take a little break now. And now we return to Baghdad with Michael Schmidt of the New York Times and Sam Dagher of the Wall Street Journal. And a reminder that there is a slight delay. I guess one of the things that hasn't improved in Iraq is telephone service.
Absolutely, and other things as well, most notably electricity. According to a recent survey by the Ministry of Planning and the UN, Iraqis get on average nationwide, 7.6 hours of electricity from the national grid.
Just less than 8 hours a day? Wow. I've also read recently.
They supplement that.
Excuse me, say that again?
No, I said they supplement that with neighborhood generators that supply power to people's homes as well.
I've read that 1 million Iraqi women have become widows as a result of the war and violence. Hasn't there been concern about how the lives of Iraqi women may change after the troop withdrawal?
there've been concerns about a lot of things, Leonard. I mean, it's really a country that's emerging from decades of war, and a country that's trying to sort of rebuild itself, and all the, you know, the current political feuding and squabbling doesn't help one bit.
Well, the how does the security situation and lack of equality impact on women in their daily lives? Women have become targets in post-Mubarak Egypt. Is something similar likely to occur in Iraq?
Well, I think it's too early. I mean, women, I mean, do enjoy, I mean, again, I mean, there are silver linings to a lot of the changes that have occurred in Iraq, you know, after the U.S. invasion in 2003, the top of Saddam Hussein, namely, you know, liberties and obviously, I mean, there have been recent concerns about human rights and you know, allegations of the torture of prisoners and the way, you know, Maliki dealt with you know, some of the protests that erupted in Baghdad earlier this year. But nonetheless, I mean, there is to some extent a free press. There is women do enjoy certain rights that, you know, they weren't able to enjoy under the previous regime. And there are, you know, a healthy number of women in parliament. So it's not a gloomy picture, a totally gloomy picture.
Michael, can you explain the longstanding dispute over how to share power in Kirkuk between Arabs, Kurds, and Turkmen?
It's a longstanding thing that the Iraqi government was going to try and tackle, but hasn't been able to tackle. It's sort of like the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but in Iraq, where different people, different groups are claiming different parts of the land, and it's sort of at a stalemate. And one of the biggest issues for Iraq with the United States leaving is what's going to happen in Kirkuk, because the military was heavily engaged up there. The military was doing patrols with the different security forces of the Kurds and security forces of the Arabs up there, and they were basically keeping the peace. Now, when the U.S. left, all of those what they call trilateral security patrols ended. And, you know, it's sort of a looming question over the country what will happen in Kirkuk and whether, you know, something small could set off, you know, immense violence there as it has been in the past.
Are there similar power struggles between ethnic groups in other parts of the country?
Yes, there are, but the most pronounced fight over land and over control of land is in Kirkuk, and that is sort of the hotbed area, and it's an area that the United States invests an enormous amount of time in. And now there's not a lot of that. There's none of that from the Americans. So it's sort of a, you know, everyone's kind of waiting to see what will happen in Kirkuk, and meanwhile you have so many other things, you know, that appear to be falling apart across the country.
Like the fight over who can control the oil. Have many people have argued that the invasion of Iraq was all about oil. Have American oil companies benefited from the fall of Saddam?
They have benefited, but not in the way that people think they have. There are far less American oil companies here pumping oil, you know, getting oil from Iraq than foreign companies like BP or, you know, and stuff like that. But what there is here is the American companies that help, you know, do the services of the oil fields and help actually get the stuff out of the ground. But it actually, Iraq didn't turn out to be the great oil producer for the United States they thought it was. On the other hand, Iraq is producing more oil than they were. You know, Iraq is producing oil, and, you know, there's the thought that that will put the amount of oil that Iraq is putting on the market will push down the price of oil across the world, and that would benefit the United States.
Well, has the division of who will get the oil wealth been determined yet? And the whole matter of whether oil profits will help Iraq rebuild itself?
Well, the big thing will be in coming years when the oil money starts to really come in. Are the Iraqis able to take that to rebuild the infrastructure of the country and invest in the country to develop other parts of their economy to, you know, to get other, to get people working. The problem is that oil accounts for, you know, a ridiculous 30%, almost like 90% of the country's economy, and the other parts of the economy just are functioning. So what Iraq really needs to be doing is taking money from the oil and investing it domestically to try and get other parts, you know, trying to get people working in other industries. But that's still caught on yet, and there's massive unemployment and underemployment, and that's, you know, that's the root of a lot of these problems.
Sam, what do Iraqi people tell you about their feelings about the withdrawal? Do they appear to be hopeful for the future?
Well, Leonard, a lot of the people that I spoke to, whether myself here in Baghdad or some of my colleagues in places like Basra in the south and Fallujah, you remember Fallujah, the place where Americans fought some pretty hard battles and lost a lot of lives. People there in all these places actually don't believe that the Americans have left. There's really a state of disbelief among a lot of Iraqis.
They just don't, but don't they see, didn't they see the troops leave?
they do. I mean, it's been aired on, you know, on local TV stations, but they say, well, you know, how about the embassy? And we've heard that, you know, the Americans want to keep 15,000 to 16,000 people here, including contractors, and they say, well, that's the military. I mean, according to Iraqis. And then I had one guy here in Karada in central Baghdad tell me, you know, come on, you know, don't be a fool. I mean, the Americans spent billions to get to Iraq. They're not going to leave it so easily.
There were about 4,500 American casualties in Iraq since 2003. Do we know how many Iraqis have died?
Well, I mean, that's still a great source of controversy, but it seems like at least from some of the leaked classified U.S. military memo that we now possibly at least 100,000 and maybe more.
Michael, we've heard a lot about how the Iraqi army and the police force have been under constant attack from insurgents, and that they also haven't always been the most competent. What is the current state of them? Is the country being left in good hands?
Well, the interesting thing about Iraq over the past year, when I got here at the end of January for the first time, is that you didn't see many American troops as you went across the country because the Iraqis had the lead in security and had it for some time. So the Iraqis have been protecting the streets and policing the streets for, you know, for like at least 2 years now. And the thing about that is that, you know, a lot of people in the United States thought that when the troops left, that the troops were leaving the streets. The troops had left the streets, you know, 2 years ago. So what will happen here is that the Iraqi security forces, which have a decent amount of control of the country, and, you know, there's no fighting in the streets, you know, there are, you know, roadside bomb attacks and assassinations, they will continue to get stronger. You know, they will continue to be trained by American contractors that are here, and the recruitment numbers will continue to get bigger, and they'll continue to develop more experience, and, you know, hopefully they'll continue on the upward path, and that will push down on the other violence that still remains.
My guests are Michael Schmidt of the New York Times and Sam Dagher of the Wall Street Journal. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned Muqtada al-Sadr earlier, who has been an outspoken opponent of the American presence. Will that change at all now? Sam?
Leonard, is that a question for myself?
Either one of you. You know, yeah, in fact, you could both jump in and add to what the other one has said. It's perfectly all right with me. You both know an awful lot.
I would just add, I mean, just to go back to the security forces, I would just add to what Michael said. I mean, the problem now is, yes, I mean, they're well-trained, they're well-equipped and all of that, but the problem is, you know, once you start having these major political battles unfolding, I mean, you have to wonder about the ultimate loyalties of a lot of these people. And one of the overriding concerns of, from Sunnis, that, you know, that all both the Army and, the security forces that are under the control of the Ministry of Interior are dominated by Shia. And we had a story in the Wall Street Journal a couple months ago about this and how the Sunnis wanted more balance. So, and then the fact that Maliki has pretty much appointed all the division commanders in the army, and they all report to him. And we saw that play out in Diyala, a province that I visited yesterday, where Maliki pretty much was able to crush, a local bid for more autonomy from the central government by the sheer fact that, there are 25,000 policemen and soldiers in the province that report directly to him. So I think there are big question marks about, who these forces side with once this, political battle really intensifies.
Maliki promised that he'd stand up to Iran and keep it from meddling in Iraqi politics. Did he just say that to appease the Americans?
No, I think he truly means it, and he has actually done so in the past. And if you recall, in 2008, he stood up to militia that were splinter groups from Muqtada Sadr's Mehdi army, and he fought them in Basra, he fought them in Baghdad, and then in 2009 he ran independently on a sort of tough state of law platform, independent from his Iranian backed allies, Shia allies, and did pretty well, and he did the same again in 2010 in the national election. So he's actually come out publicly and confronted Iran. And then in the interview that I had with him before his trip to Washington, he also reminded me of the fact that he in 2008, he flew to Tehran and basically confronted Iranian officials with U.S. evidence that they were sending, these EFPs, these explosively formed projectiles, which were responsible for the death of many soldiers here, and actually told Iranians, this has to stop. So he does have, a record of actually confronting the Iranians. But the problem is, in the midst of this power struggle that's going on, he does have to tread a tight rope, On the one hand, his eagerness for a strategic relationship with the U.S., and on the other hand, the pressure from Iranians and people like Sadr. I mean, Sadr is an important component of the coalition government. He has 5 to 6 ministers in the government and 40 members of parliament as well. So I mean, Sadr, you had asked me about him earlier. He has evolved from this scrappy militia leader and really some sophisticated politician who is at the helm of this movement that, has does to some extent still maintain a military arm, but also, has a charitable, social arm, has even a financial arm. So he's really diversified, and his model is, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Iranian-backed militant group.
Michael, we haven't heard much about al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, the Sunni insurgent group. Have they been pretty much, because so many of their leaders have been killed, have they lost much of their effectiveness?
I would say that they are probably still the most potent terrorist organization in the country. They still have the ability every, 4 to 6 to 8 weeks to pull off a massive attack that kills a lot of people. The attack cycles used to be much shorter. They used to be 2 weeks or a week or, even a month. But, because of the pressure that the Americans helped the Iraqis put on al-Qaeda, the attack cycles lengthened. But they are still very potent. The United States government estimates that there's between 800 to 1,000, members of al-Qaeda still operating in this country. And the real concern is that because the American military left and the capabilities of the intelligence sharing from the Americans and the special forces assistance that the U.S. was providing to the Iraqis, that they knew when they were going on midnight raids just to try and target these guys. And the question is whether the Iraqis will be able to fight al-Qaeda as well without the Americans, backing them. So that really remains to be seen. But the al-Qaeda has been quiet in recent weeks, but that doesn't mean that they've gone away by any means.
The Times published a piece last week that said, quote, "The lack of a painful but cathartic process of reckoning with its history, as South Africa and other countries have done, has stymied Iraqi society's ability to vanquish the ghosts of the past." So is there a sense that people are still harboring fears and resentments from Saddam Hussein's rule? And would a truth and reconciliation process be of much value?
Never a reconciliation process here, and the fault lines that have been exposed this week between Maliki and the Sunnis sort of show that you know, they're really, you know, from what on, especially from what went on after Saddam fell, that none of that really has been resolved. The violence has stopped, the fighting in the streets has stopped, and it's stopped for some years. But at the same time, there was never really any reconciliation. And what happens is when there's no reconciliation, things, you know, can heat up very quickly, as we've seen, you know, this week.
Now, I throw this out to both of you because this concerns both of you. Do the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal plan to maintain bureaus in Iraq in the near future?
We plan to be here.
In our case,
for, you know,
sorry, go ahead.
Well, okay, let's begin with you, Sam.
We plan to be.
I don't care which one.
We're fighting it out.
Yeah, well, you know, your two papers are in serious competition here in New York, so I'm not surprised. Okay, let's begin with you, Sam. You going to keep a bureau in Baghdad into the near future?
I think we're currently studying this. We haven't made up the final decision yet.
And what about the New York Times, Michael?
We just signed a 2-year lease on the compound where we are, and we think that this is an incredibly important story going forward because, you know, what we came here to do, you know, what the military came here to do is, you know, try and establish a democratic elect. So now, you know, we have a front row seat to see whether that's really going to happen.
Has it been easier for journalists to work in the country in recent years?
I think definitely.
You both say yes. And I thank both of you so much for being with us today. Michael Schmidt of the New York Times and Sam Dagher of the Wall Street Journal. It's been a pleasure talking with you, even with that annoying 5-second delay.